Good evening. It's just about time for us to get started with our class this evening. Thank you for being here as we continue on in our study of the book of Judges. Today's the 19th, so our plan is to cover chapters 4 and 5, which if you did the reading, you know that it really just encompasses one event or one grouping of events, whereas last week we talked about three different judges. Tonight we're going to talk about one, Deborah, and then her military commander, the military commander, Barak. For next week, we're going to plan to cover chapter 6, which is going to start talking about Gideon, and we'll actually spend 2 weeks on Gideon. So chapters 6 through 8 are Gideon, and as I mentioned last week, this is going to kind of serve as an inflection point in the book of Judges, where the judges go from being admirable, noble examples, good leaders of Israel, to then subsequently including Gideon's later life. What we know about it, as well as later judges like Jephthah and especially Samson, where they're not good examples to be following, and they're especially not leading necessarily a coalition of Israelites to battle against evil. They're just kind of going out against people on their own, but still, in many cases, under God's direction. So that'll be our plan for the next few weeks. Briefly, our class last week, we finished the first part of Judges. You remember those are the two introductory chapters, chapters 1 and 2, where it described the incomplete conquests in the land of Canaan, Joshua's death, and then toward the latter part of chapter 2, the cycle that we read about several times in chapter 3 and that we'll read about again tonight, where Israelites fall away from God. They cry out because they're oppressed by the people that he sends to plunder them. He rescues them with a judge. They have peace under the period of that judge, and then they fall back. They relapse into the same pattern. That's what's going to happen at the very onset here in chapter 4. And the three judges that we talked about last week as part of part 2 of Judges, which is the majority, chapters 3 through 16, were Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. And again, they all battled against God's enemies, against Israel's enemies, and were noble examples for the other Israelites to follow. With that said, though, we're going to pick up now in chapter 4, which is the account of Deborah. And in chapter 4, they're battling against, really, Sisera, who was the commander of Jabin's army, which we'll talk more about in just a minute. So Deborah is the judge, and then Barak is the military commander that she encourages to step up to the plate, so to speak, and to take charge of the armies and go ahead and lead that coalition of Israelite forces against these Canaanites to defeat them, as God commanded. Regrettably, as we see at the very beginning of chapter 4, the people again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died, which was the judge we talked about for the majority of chapter 3. Remember, Ehud was the one who killed Eglon there in Jericho or the city of palms. But now, after the peace that ensued after Ehud's reign, they've fallen back into evil, probably idolatry, but it could have included other things. And so the Lord raises up Jabin, a king in Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And we'll have a map in just a moment of this area. But for now, this is what Hazor looks like today. Interestingly, back in Joshua, there was also a Jabin who was defeated by Joshua and the Israelites at that time. But that's a different one. And we know that because at that time, in Joshua chapter 11, Joshua put that Jabin to death. So it can't be the same guy here in Judges. So it's kind of like Pharaoh or king. This is a title that someone inherited as a leader in Hazor. So a different one that we read about in Joshua chapter 11. But God raised him up to oppress the Israelites. He reigned in Hazor. And his commander was Sisera. And so we're really going to read mostly about Sisera tonight, and Deborah and Barak's efforts and the Israelites' efforts against him. So Jabin was from Hazor, and Sisera's home was a place called Hareseth Hagoyim, which may mean forested area of the Gentiles. The record says that the Israelites were oppressed by these plunderers for 20 years, and they cry out to God for help. It's also helpful to remember that during this time in the land of Canaan, there were different city-states, independent city-states throughout the land, and their rulers were also dispersed throughout the land. So when we read about Jabin, a king of Canaan, it's not like Jabin was ruling over all Israel, but really more toward just the northern part of Israel, the land of Canaan, as we'll come to see on the map in just a moment. So he's the one oppressing the people of Israel, and the commander of his army, again, is Sisera. And then starting in verse 4, we're introduced to Deborah. And we're told a few things about her, that she's a judge, she's a prophetess, and she's the wife of a man named Lapidoth. And probably as you noticed or noted in your Bible study, there aren't many prophetesses mentioned in the Bible, even in the Old Testament. Can someone think of another prophetess in the Old Testament? Who's that? Anna, the prophetess. I think she may have been in the New Testament in John, but under Old Testament times, technically. So I'll accept it. Yeah. Who else was called a prophetess? Remember? Wyatt? Yes, that's right. Moses' sister, Miriam, is called a prophetess in Exodus 15:20. And there are three other women in the Old Testament who are called prophetesses there. But a small group, especially compared to all of the male prophets that we read about. But that's a role that she served. And we'll see that actually in her communications with Barak, where she is relaying to him God's will, saying, you need to, again, I'm paraphrasing, get up, get the army together, and move against Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army. So she was stationed under a palm tree in the hill country of Ephraim, and it said that the Israelites would come to her for judgment. So remember when we talked about in our introductory class that these judges would serve two main functions, a judicial function where they would help resolve cases and issues and disputes among the people, and then also a military function where they would lead an army against God's enemies. Well, we can see in this account those distinctly because Deborah herself does not lead Israel's forces. That's what she motivates Barak to do in this instance. But mainly, we're told that she would judge Israel, and she also, again, serves as a prophetess. So she summons Barak, who's called the son of Abinoam, and relates to him God's will to defeat Sisera and ultimately King Jabin. You notice that in relaying God's will to Barak, she says, God says, I will draw out Sisera to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand. And so again, something we've seen several times throughout the narrative so far is that when God's speaking of these conquests, he's speaking of it as a done deal. It hadn't yet been accomplished, but God's speaking of it as a certainty. And that should have been good enough for the listener to say, okay, God said this is going to happen. I should have full faith that it's going to happen. But as we can see in Barak's case, and especially as we're going to see with Gideon starting next week, it's not enough. Where they needed some extra motivation, encouragement, in the case of Gideon, extra signs to be performed before their faith was strong enough to prompt them to the action that they needed to take. I do want to highlight a difference in verse 6, where the ESV translates Deborah's message to Barak from God in this way, where it says, has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? So in that way, by phrasing it as a question, it seems like Deborah is referring back to a command that had previously been given that Barak may have ignored, not heeded. But the NIV, to contrast that, listen to how it's translated here. This is verse 6, she sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kedesh and Naphtali, and said to him, the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you. Go take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun and lead them up to Mount Tabor. So I don't think that Barak had been previously given a command that he ignored. I think Deborah here is relaying to him as a prophetess, this is what God is telling me to tell you to do. So get the army ready and go up to battle against Sisera. And so we have a look here. This is the bottom here of the Lake of Chinnereth, as it's known in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, it's known as the Sea of Galilee or of Tiberias. So we know that well from Jesus' ministry. So that's, I think, cool, for lack of a better word, that all of these things are happening in and around the area where Jesus spent much of his ministry, you know, 1,000 years after these events took place. And I'll have more pictures in the next few slides, but it's thought that Jael, who we will read about in a moment, was here in her tent, and that Sisera and the Canaanites came up to battle Barak's forces here in the valley of Jezreel. And this is actually the same place where we'll start reading next week, or the week after next, where Gideon and his forces stage their battle against the Midianites, Amalekites, and the people from the east. So the very same battleground, though separated by some number of years. How does Barak respond to Deborah's commissioning him to step up and lead the forces? That's right, yeah. He says, if you go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. I think that demonstrates pretty clearly an initial lack of faith on his behalf. I don't want us to be too hard on him, but I think that's clear from his response here. And Deborah graciously responds and says in verse 9, I will surely go with you. But she says, the road on which you go will not lead to your glory. Another way to translate that would be, due to the way you are going about this, meaning that because he was hesitant and didn't fully trust in God's promise to achieve a victory on this occasion, she's saying, because of the way you're going about this, you're not going to have the glory from this. But the glory would go to whom? A woman. And probably, if I was Barak, I would think, well, it's going to be Deborah. It's not Deborah, as we'll come to find out in just a few verses. He calls up, though, to his credit, the 10,000 men from Zebulun and Naphtali, and they go to Kedesh with Deborah. And so here we have what it looks like today, obviously, where Barak's forces were assembled here at Mount Tabor. Sisera and his 900 chariots approach here from this direction, whatever it is, maybe south or north, I don't know. But and then they fight here in the valley of Jezreel. So it's thought that there were stages to this battle, and that's mainly because of additional information that's given in the song in chapter 5, that the initial stages of the battle between Sisera and Barak happened on the plain west of Mount Tabor. And once they were put to flight, the Canaanites, they fled back toward Megiddo, but they met the Kishon River. And so it's thought that those 900 chariots, which would have been a great military asset in a valley like this, when they encountered the river, had been rendered useless or a liability. And in fact, if you go to chapter 5 in the song, you can see in verse 4, it says, Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the region of Eden, the earth trembled and the heavens dropped. Yes, the clouds dropped water. And then again, go down to verse 21, the torrent Kishon swept them away, the ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon, march on my soul with might. So it could be understood that as part of achieving victory for the Israelites, God caused there to be a torrential downpour, and that swelled the Kishon River, which is right out there. And then when the chariots were trying to continue to move their warriors and continue on in battle, it rendered them useless and actually a liability. We'll get more on that in just a minute. I'll stop there and ask, does anybody have any questions or comments before we go on? Yes, sir, Ed.
At the point that Deborah tells him that he's not going to have the honor here, I think it was because she was seeing that he had doubts as to God giving them victory. God told him to go and delivered that word through a prophet that he had revealed his word to, and it should have been done deal in his mind, and it wasn't. And so she told him, no honor for you today.
Yes.
You're not going to get it. Good but point. It will be God's promise that will be accomplished.
Yes. Something else I thought of, to Barak's credit, is that he didn't just give up at that point. So he didn't just say, well, there's no glory in it for me, so I'm not interested in pursuing this. He didn't keep that from stepping up and doing what needed to be done. But you're right, that ultimately glory was not going to be his. JR, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, one of the things in just reading on this from a comment in the previous class, at this time, we have the whole priest system set up. The priest system is set up. They have the tabernacle, and that is the, if you will, the religious side of things. Deborah is actually a judge. I think sometimes people get confused when she's a judge, and because she's a prophetess, she goes and tells somebody something that she's somehow some type of religious leader or priestess. She's not. She's a prophetess, and that is a distinctly different role that I think people often get confused about.
Yeah, that's a good distinction. Thanks for making that. JD?
About God commanding you is the same thing that Jethro says to Moses when he's giving him advice about, you know, delegating smaller matters. He says, if you do this thing and God commands you, which is also translated in different ways. So I guess it's a tricky phrase.
Okay.
That was similar. But Brock, whatever, however you pronounce it, he's in Hebrews. In the list, you know, the little summary list of Gideon and Barak and Jephthah. So his faith seems to grow. But it also, he was willing to go. He didn't continue to protest as long as she went with him.
Yes, good point.
Sometimes we need that.
Yeah.
Somebody to go with us, but we're willing to do it.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one thing, just real quick. Back in school, they did something called a strengths finder. I don't know if y'all have ever done that, but you answer like 200 questions, and it tells you what your top 5 strengths are, and then it tells you what kind of people you need to work with to complement your strengths. So their philosophy is not to work on your weaknesses. They don't even talk about weaknesses, which I think is ridiculous. But besides that, they tell you what your top 5 strengths are, and then they tell you the kind of people you need to work with to complement your strengths. And so I found out that I'm like Barak. I'm not one to act. And so I need to work with someone who spurs me on to go ahead and, you know, get done what needs to be done, to either work with someone or marry someone like that. But I'll just leave it there. All right, so as things progress, it's said that God fights, of course, on Israel's behalf. The chariots and the army flee, and they're pursued by Barak. But Sisera flees on foot. I'm just going to catch up here in my notes. There is an aside in verse 11 about Heber the Kenite. And the Kenites were mentioned back in chapter 1 as relatives and descendants of the father-in-law of Moses. Here he's called Hobab. Previously, we knew him as Jethro, as J.D. mentioned, but also Reuel. There is a little bit of confusion because in Numbers chapter 10, starting in verse 29, Hobab is referred to as Moses' brother-in-law, as in the son of Jethro. Here he's called Moses' father-in-law. Easiest way to explain it to me is that they both shared the name, like I have the same first name as my father, in addition to the other names that he was referred to as, Jethro and Reuel. So all that to say, Heber the Kenite was different from the other Kenites because he had moved away from them about 100 miles to the north of where the other Kenites were located as a nomadic people. And was Heber's clan friendly to the Israelites or unfriendly, or friendly to Jabin? In verse 17. That's right. So these Kenites were friendly not to the Israelites, but to their enemy. And that will come into play in just a moment. So back to the story. Just as God had foretold through Deborah, Sisera calls up, remember this is the commander of Jabin's army, his 900 chariots and all the men with him. They travel to Kishon, or the river here. Deborah tells Barak, up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you? And on this occasion, God achieves a great victory and defeat against Sisera's army by Barak's hand while Sisera abandons his chariot and escapes on foot. We learn from chapter 5, which we'll talk about in just a moment, that, as I mentioned previously, the chariots were mired in the river. And we also learned that there were additional tribes that had been summoned. We'll talk more about that. But additionally, there were tribes that were summoned but didn't respond to the call. So this was almost a complete Israelite offensive. The call went out from Barak for many Israelites to come join this battle against Sisera and eventually against Jabin, king of Canaan, but not everybody responded. Briefly, the Kishon River, just for your reference, until apparently about 100 years ago, I don't know what changed, but until about 100 years ago, it was the second largest stream in Israel outside of the Jordan River. It's about 43 miles long and drains an area of about 420 square miles. And so just like the Jordan River or any other undammed river, in a torrential rain, it would have swollen and caused great upset to the chariots, but also to the foes of God. And I also wanted to elaborate more on JD's point that Barak is mentioned. This is where he kind of falls out of the narrative a little bit before the account of Sisera in jail takes over. But he is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 32, along with Gideon, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and prophets. And you'll notice in verse 34 of Hebrews chapter 11, it says that these individuals, some of them, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, and put foreign armies to flight. So I think that well describes Barak here. His faith was weak. He still had faith. It was weak. But he was made strong out of that weakness. In the course of this battle and with Deborah's encouragement and him seeing the results of God battling on Israel's behalf, he became mighty in war, and certainly he put foreign armies to flight. So he led. He was hesitant, but he did lead the Israelites in battle against God's enemies. And it's notable in chapter 5 in the song, it said that the people, the armies, went into the valley. They rushed at his, Barak's, heels. So that speaks to the quality of the man as far as a leader goes, that all of these thousands of people, all these thousands of soldiers were willing to follow him into battle. So I made the point briefly last week, but I want to make it again just because I think it's a worthwhile one and ask you if there's someone in your life like Barak who needs your encouragement and motivation to step up and do the right thing. In that case, we should be like Deborah. Share with that person God's assurances, the promise he's made, and how following his will lead to a blessed life. Think of 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 14. We urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. So I know I said that was going to be our takeaway for today, but since I spoiled it last week, I had to come up with a different one. So you'll still have to be in suspense about that. What comments or questions do y'all have about the narrative up through verse 16? Darrell.
When I first was reading through this again this time, it struck me that the reason she tells him originally that the glory isn't going to go to him, it's going to go to a woman, I think is because his faith was weak, and so that when it was over and he had the victory, and then it ends the way she said, that had to be very encouraging. At least I think it would have been to him, and perhaps that's why he's in Hebrews, is because through the whole thing, and even when she says how it's going to go, she prophesied there, and it did. But the specific detail, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. And I think chapter 5, which is not just Deborah's song, but his song as well, all the things that they, sentiments that they shared in that song together, speak to the growth of his faith. All right, moving on now to verse 17 with the real interesting part of the story. Sisera, having abandoned his chariot, fleeing on foot to, again, the tent of a supposed ally, Heber the Kenite, and he's met not by him but by his wife, Jael. She summons him into her tent and conceals him with a rug or a blanket. She asks him for water. She gives him milk, and then she's told to stand guard by the door and to lie if anyone asks if someone is inside. So it's not clear what her motivation was, and it's not clear if this was her intention to do what she's about to do the whole time. But while he's asleep on the floor, wrapped in the blanket or the rug, she approaches him and, using a tent peg and a hammer, kills him while he's asleep. Barak, after having wiped out Sisera's army, is now, we learn, trying to follow up with where did Sisera go, and he comes to her tent, and she opens the door and shows him the proof inside of Sisera dead on the floor. So in this act, she actually echoes Ehud's action, where, remember, Ehud, he took and reached for that weapon that he had concealed and drove it into Eglon. She's doing a very similar thing here. But it's significant that this is a non-Israelite. Jael is not a part of Israel. She's part of this clan that defected from the Kenites, separate from Moses' family and the descendants of Israel. And it's also important to note that after Sisera was subdued, notice in verse 23, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, before the people of Israel, and the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. So this wasn't just about Sisera and his army. This was the beginning of an effort against these Canaanites to completely wipe them out, as God had commanded them. And again, was practice for the Israelites to develop their battle skills, as God had promised back at the beginning of chapter 3. And so while we emphasize the individual acts of these judges, like Deborah and Barak, notice that it wasn't just them. It was the army and then the Israelites, this coalition of forces that followed their lead to conquer these foes. It's hard to imagine how one judge could have achieved all this on their own. And it speaks to the people's willingness to follow their leaders. And again, it's not going to be the case as we go on through the book of Judges, but certainly is and has been so far. So in this episode, and as the song, which we'll discuss in just a moment, indicates, God achieves the victory over his enemies, even with the help of a hesitant military commander and a woman from an enemy group of people, being the family of Heber, the Kenites. Significantly, Deborah's actions, if you didn't notice, if it didn't strike you, especially compared to Samson's actions or Gideon's actions that we'll read about later on, her actions and her words consistently pointed to God, to him, not away from him, and not onto herself. And again, that's in stark contrast to the poor choices of judges we'll read about later, like Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. So with that, that's all I have to say about chapter 4, which is the account, and now we'll go through the song, just highlighting some of the areas that may have you may have scratched your head at while reading through, and if there are other things that when you're reading through the song you didn't understand, please bring those up and we'll try and discuss them as well. But I'll pause here and ask if anybody has questions or comments before we go on. Kaylin.
Things, it's just, they did some very intense, hard things that you have to be really strong to do. And sometimes I think we kind of downplay strength and, I don't know, I just feel like in modern day times, which I understand we're not like literally going to war and that kind of thing today here. But there still is importance of like the strength and violence when necessary in defense of others and in doing the right thing, you know? And I don't know, I just feel like that is, we overemphasize softness, if that makes sense. But when you read the scriptures, the strength is so important. And I think you see that in little boys, like they have this desire to be strong and protect, and they might be what some would consider violent. And I don't think that should be fully discouraged from them because it needs to be directed in a godly way.
Good point.
As the father of boys, I'll say that meekness is what we're going for, where yes, you have strength, you have confidence, and faith, but it's under control, that you're exercising under control and always using good judgment about the path that you're going to go to resolve a certain situation. So not always resorting to physical to resolve an issue. Yeah. All right. Let's move on now. Have you seen these pictures before? All right. I'm hoping to incorporate them into every class so that by the time we get to the end of it, we'll all have them memorized. Okay. So we'll get to that in a little bit. Chapter 5 introduces Judges' only song, but one that joins a growing list of songs in the Old Testament. So Moses, in Exodus 15, delivered the Israelites a song where he began it with saying, "I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously." That was after they passed through the Red Sea. He had delivered them from the Egyptians. And then, and I meant to mention this in our introductory class, Moses' song in Deuteronomy 32, toward the end of his life, actually, he states, would be a witness against the Israelites when they became unfaithful in the land of Canaan. That reference for you is Deuteronomy 31, 19, and 21. So here, Deborah and Barak join together in song, and they first commend Israel's leaders for stepping up to the task and for the people's willingness to follow. So this is how it's supposed to work. Leaders are to step up, be strong, and lead the people to do God's will. It seems like the original audience in verse 3 are the kings and princes remaining in the land of Canaan, but it expands later. You'll notice that he talks about in verse 10, those who ride on white donkeys, sit on rich carpets, and who walk by the way. I think those are the well-to-do and also the common folk among the Israel. So really, this song is for everybody. It's a great testament to both of their faith that they so openly glorify God and challenge the remaining Canaanites to heed the words of this song. You notice that Deborah says, and Barak said in this song, in verse 7, the villagers ceased in Israel. They ceased to be until I arose. I, Deborah, arose as a mother in Israel. So they're seeming to be saying that normal life, village life, had ceased to operate, that things had gotten so bad that people were not able to function as they normally would until Deborah, Barak, other leaders stepped up to take the lead. Starting now in verse 10, she directs the words of the song, again, as I mentioned, to those who ride on white donkeys, sit on rich carpets, and walk by the way, referring, I think, to all Israelites, whether well-to-do or more of the common folks. And as we start in verses 14, she calls out, or they call out, many tribes by name. And as you read through that list, is there one in verse 14 that stands out as a tribe you don't recognize? Yes, Machir, which you see on the map is labeled here. So Manasseh is split into two portions, this eastern portion here and a western portion here. And so it's likely that Machir refers to the western part of the tribe of Manasseh. So Machir was, if I'm saying it right, was the son of Manasseh. Manasseh was the son of Joseph. Machir was the son of Manasseh. And then Gilead, who's later mentioned, was a son of Machir, so grandson of Joshua. Your references for that are Genesis 50 and verse 23 and Numbers 26 and 29. So Machir and Gilead are just two different ways of referring to the tribes of Manasseh, these two separate tribes, at least as far as they inherited the land. And Gilead, as you can see here, may also encompass the land or the tribe of Gad, which is not specifically mentioned. So these tribes responded favorably to the call of Barak. They went to help in the battle. And what a great example these are for their answering of the call to arms and helping their fellow Israelites defeat their enemies. There are other tribes who were summoned but did not present in order to help, and that is Reuben, Gad, if that is in fact part of Gilead that's mentioned, Asher, and Dan. And this is Dan before they migrated north, which we'll read about later in Judges. And so this period, or this poem, reflects the period prior to Dan's migration to the far north, as I just mentioned. And then starting in verse 19, here's a map that I promised. Hazor's up here, so that's where Jabin was stationed. This is the Sea of Galilee, and this is where they fought in the Valley of Jezreel. And the tribes that are commended above and beyond for answering the call are the ones that were in and around Jabin's direct control, Naphtali, Zebulun, and Issachar, here in the psalm. Starting in verse 19, where he says in verse 20, from heavens the stars fought, from their courses they fought against Sisera. I think these are impressionistic figures of speech indicating that even the heavenly forces were working on Israel's behalf, which was an acknowledgement that this victory was achieved not through human effort or cunning, but through God's working. And then there's another city that's mentioned, or another place that's mentioned in verse 23, and that's a place called Miraz. And to my knowledge, there's no other place that it's mentioned in the Bible, so not exactly sure where it was. Most likely was a town that may have been summoned to fight, but didn't. You notice that they incur a severe condemnation from the angel of the Lord in verse 23. The last verses of the hymn, verses 24 through 31, talk about the defeat from two different perspectives, the perspectives of two different women. First, the perspective of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, who was the one that killed Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army. And then the second woman is the mother of Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army. And in these verses are what I think really captivating and poetic descriptions of Jael's victory over Sisera. For example, back in the account, we know that Sisera was already asleep, and he was folded up or hidden in a rug or a blanket. But then when you get to the song, in verse 27, it says, "Between her feet he sank, he fell, he lay still. Between her feet he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell, dead." This is just poetic language, seeking to emphasize the fact that a woman triumphed over this great warrior, similar to what is said that she offered him back in verse 25, which in the song says, "Curds in a noble's bowl." Back in the account, it just said, he asked for water and she gave him milk. Again, I think it's just poetic equivalent to milk here in the song to emphasize the scene here in Jael's tent as she overcomes Sisera, this great warrior. And then we have the perspective from Sisera's mother, beginning in verse 28. She's described as, "Out of the window she peered, she looked, wailed through the lattice. Why is he tearing? Why isn't he back?" And she's comforted by her princesses, and even she herself says in verse 30, this is how the ESV translates it, "Have they not found and divided the spoil, a womb or two for every man? Spoiled of dyed materials for Sisera, spoil of dyed materials embroidered, two pieces of dyed work embroidered for the neck as spoil." So what do you think they're referring to when they say a womb or two for every man? A maiden or two maidens? So the NET takes a little bit of license to insert some words, and they say this, "A girl or two for each man to rape." So that's what Sisera's mother and her princesses thought was going on, why he was delayed in coming back. Of course, that wasn't the case at all. Their forces had been completely subdued. And the song concludes with, "So may all your enemies perish, O Lord, but your friends be like the sun as he rises in his might. And they have rest for 40 years. So again, that Barak and Deborah both sing this together shows a maturation in his faith, which is, again, to his credit, and I think part of the reason why we read about him in Hebrews chapter 11. So what's our takeaway for this evening? This isn't specific to Deborah and Barak, but just more of a comment on Judges, is that the faithfulness of God's people cannot be dependent on our leaders. It shouldn't be the case that we are faithful because our leaders are faithful. Certainly, it's a great blessing when we have faithful leadership, but each of us must devote ourselves individually to God's work so we can grow as the body of Christ. And as part of that work, as it relates to our leaders, we'll submit to and encourage them, but also hold them accountable. And that's our task as Christians today, especially as members of a local church, is to, again, each of us work on growing our faith, becoming stronger, so that strong leadership is a reflection of a strong local church. And that if a leader or a group of leaders goes on or moves away or passes away, we don't wither away and die because our strong leaders are no longer present, that we can continue to thrive. So that's all I have to say for tonight on Judges 4 and 5, but I think we have about a minute left before we conclude. So I'll ask if anybody has. Yes, sir.
Sisera found out that kind of the opposite of having heard, if God is for you, who can be against you? In this case, if God's against you, nobody can be for you, even the people you think are your allies. This statement, faithfulness of God's people must not depend on leadership. Elijah found out that for sure right from God's own mouth when he thought absolutely everything was corrupt all around him, he found out there were thousands that had not bowed their knees to Baal. And, you know, even here in Judges, we got the case of Chariots of Fire. You know, I think we could be overwhelmed here. Well, let's take another look. See what's surrounding us. If God is for us, nobody can be against us. It won't work.
Just once. Thank you.
One more comment. Who was it? Sorry. Yes, ma'am.
This is kind of random, but verse 6 when it's talking about Shamgar, it's talking about like how the highway was deserted and they had to use like the roundabout ways. So, like, I guess, are we assuming from that that like Shamgar had more of a military role and didn't actually do much in terms of actually protecting the people long term? Because like that's negative, right?
Oh, no, I think it's positive.
It's positive. So, I thought it would be
made if
they
can't
go to the main
right way
in
danger,
so they
got
to
do it. Okay. So Shamgar was the judge mentioned at the end of chapter 3, that the one verse is mentioned about him.
So I think it's just saying during his time in this part of Israel, in these days, the highways were abandoned. But Shamgar, in that he battled the Philistines, they're located in the southwestern portion, kind of away from all this. And so I think it may just be more of a time reference than a reflection on his leadership. But I'll give it some more thought. Thank you. All right. Thank you all very much.